It's possible you were just listening to the band at a time when nobody in your neighborhood was on Howie. And now that you can talk to WB2HWW on 6 meters, you'll find out real fast how well the equipment is working. M2GOT, K2LIW on the TechNet.
HWW with a comment, Dick. You should hear me better now.
Oh, boy, do I hear you now. Blast away.
Sting, the best receiver I ever saw on 6 meters was a Drake TR6. I didn't own one, but I had a Clayton in it. I had a friend who had one in a mobile. That had a hell of a noise marker. That was a TR4, really was a TR4 that was 220 meters, and Drake made a 6-meter radio out of it. They took a TR4, it made it to a TR6. That had 3 6JB6s, and it had the famous Drake noise blanker. Now, I will tell you this much. I was with Barry, N2NB, N2 Moonbounce, and I was sitting in front of my house, and he had a 706, the ICOM 706, and a quarter wave whip on the back of his car, and we were talking into the Midwest. When the band opens up, anything will work. This was like last summer. It was in the May or June. Me and Barry were just sitting having a cup of coffee because we had done some work at the repeater site. Barry was giving me a hand, and we had come downstairs to operate, to listen to 6 meters, and we were able to get in all over. But the question I did have, Dick, that Clover Leaf antenna, is that like the big wheel? Is that like the big wheel that they had back in the 70s? And back to you. And by the way, the Drake TR6 was the top-of-the-line radio, but back then, I had a used Clay Venus. You had to have the big bucks. That radio went for about $700, brand new, the Drake TR6. Over to you, Dick.
Quick comments on that, Howie.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to GOT in a second. Hey, I'm listening to you on the input, and you're potent. Important. What was I going to say? The 6-meter band, when it opens, they call it the magic band because it's got sporadic E, tropo, moonbounce, media scan. It's got a little bit of everything. Ionospheric, whatever. It's one hell of a band when it opens. And you get some nice capture areas on the antennas. You can get some awful nice ranges. Sometimes with very simple equipment like you were talking about with N2MB, you can talk some very long ranges when that band's in good shape. So it's going to have a increase in activity once this digital television takes over. Enter GOT, go right ahead with your... Enter GOT, go right ahead with your comment.
Just a quick comment on that. I have the same configuration as Barry, N2MB. We exchange notes about the common antenna that I'm using. I have to find out how I could adjust the antenna on 6 meters. It might be fixed, but I could be wrong about that. And how the SWR is adjusted for the 6-meter element. It's built in, there's no other coils to attach to it. It's built into the antenna. It's a UHV6 made by Comet. And it is resonant on FM. It's not too resonant on a single sideband. So I guess I can, lengthen the antenna in order to adjust it properly. But I am using the same configuration as Barry, so I'll give it another try.
Hey, you got a couple of choices here. You can check with Barry as to what he did. The FM portion, I guess, is 56.525 and frequencies like that. Whereas the sideband portion is more like 50.125, I think it is. The lower portion of the band, you can get there by clipping something onto the tip of the antenna, adding some extra capacitance to electrically lengthen it. I'm pretty sure you can tune your antenna down. That's the easy direction most of the time. So I think you can make that work. And is the cloverleaf a big wheel? I think so, but I'm not sure. But when you talk to K2UIH or WB2 Lima, lettuce, tomatoes, and mayonnaise, WB2LTM, you will rapidly find out what antenna they're using. I've seen the antenna with my own eyes. I think it was homebrew. And not a heck of a lot of hardware there. unusual looking structure to be hanging from the bumper of an automobile. At least one of those automobiles was an MGB at one time, as I remember, a sports car. And to see this antenna hanging off the bumper is significant. But it gave them some awfully good service. Anybody with any further questions on this, give me your call. It is K2RIW.
Did you ever play with a TR-6?
No, I've never owned a TR-6. I'm sorry to say, but it sounds like an awful nice rig. I was working with a guy who had the Clegg Zeus and Clegg Interceptor. Quite pricey in those days, but man, they were sort of the state of the art at that time. Clegg made some awful nice equipment in the late 50s and early 60s, didn't he, Howie? HWW, RIW?
I had it.
Yeah, I'd like to hear what you said. You're going to have to go back to the high power mode, Howie. And N2GOT, and then I'm going to pass it over to Mel. Is there a relationship between the Big Wheel and the Cloverleaf? I know you had the Saturn 6, you had the Halos, you had the Big Wheels and the Cloverleaf, and is Big Wheel and Cloverleaf the same antenna? It could be. N2GOT, K2RIW. Yeah, Howie just came back from Timonium. I know he must be tired and wants to go into the house. K2KEY, have you ever used, you and your guys at the Kings County Radio Club, have you ever used a Cloverleaf antenna? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, my 6 meters got very popular, if you remember back in the late 50s or 60s, early 60s, when it was open to the technicians. And so I knew a lot of technicians around the area in order to really communicate with them. That was the band, you know, that they were all on. So the problem, of course, was I always loved to fool around with 6 meters and all. I did work some cross band with it. When we tried out, we'd get together with a friend of mine was stationed that time down in the canal zone. It was a KZ5CS at the time in the canal zone. And then we switch over to 6 meters, and we did make contact a number of times on 6 meters. But I was running a bit of power that time from the home QTH with a good beam on 6 meters, which, of course, created havoc. Should I say the word again? Havoc in capital H, A, and V, on and on. I won't even go there anymore because, lucky, I'm still alive. Let me let it drop. Well, I went over to operating then a lot of mobile, 6 meter mobile. I used the Halo antenna. I had homebrew equipment in the mobile, and if I kept moving, it was pretty good. But remember, that was all AM. There was only AM operation. It was not a single sideband. So that's my experiences on 6 meters, Dick, with the Halo antenna, which I found worked extremely well on 6 meters over.
And although the Halo is no longer manufactured in the United States, to my knowledge, maybe it is a European manufacturer, but if you had to homebrew it, it's not that difficult. The raw materials that goes into one of those is not super expensive. It is a little bit it's not a miniature antenna. A 432 Mobile antenna would be a nice small thing, and a 6 meter Halo for a Mobile is a little on the massive side. Not everyone would want to tuck one of those onto the family automobile. Very different than a mag mount whip, so to speak. However, just because you think it's going to be cross-polarized, don't give up on 6 meter sideband just because the only thing you've got is a vertically polarized whip. It's a darn good beginning antenna, and you will talk to people. And when you flip over to the horizontally polarized one and you expect to see a huge improvement, you're going to see an improvement. It's not going to be night and day, mobile to fixed and mobile to mobile. That's an opinion based on my 2 meter experience with being cross-polarized. K2KEY, with any delay, K2RIW.
KC2KXV with a comment.
Mr. KXV, start off with your name and give us your comment, sir.
Roger, good to hear you, Dick. KC2KXV, Vinny, here in Manhattan. And I did an experiment with N1DVL with about a kilowatt on 6 meters where we tried a my 5/8 wave 2 meter, which was a quarter wave on 6, and the M squared halo. I'll let it drop. And what we found was on the vertical, I had about 40 miles. He was throwing a kilowatt at me with a 7-element M squared beam. I had about 40 miles. We did it from Springfield to on I-90. And then when we switched to the loop, the horizontal, he tracked me all the way down to the George Washington Bridge, and I could drop to 20 watts. So at least the ground wave, it was a big difference.
So in order to make this a little easier for us to understand, roughly how many miles did you get on each one of those antennas? Back to you, Vinny.
Roger. So from if you had N1DVL in Springfield, Mass., if we were to draw maybe on a pendulum, we went about 42, 45 miles on I-90 in either direction. And then when I went to Boston, switched to the halo, and then passed him again from Springfield, Mass., down to the George Washington Bridge, probably about 160 miles.
So your experience then on 6 meters is that using horizontal polarization, when the guy talking to you was horizontal, you went from 40 miles up to 100 and some odd miles, a significant range improvement. Could any of that have been operating conditions for that particular day and terrain, or do you have reason to believe that almost all of it was the antenna? Did you have any chance to, during that 100-mile trip to flip back and forth between the antennas? Over to you, Vinny.
Negative. I didn't flip on the antennas, but I was taking the trip a lot, Dick, and found that the horizontal always worked. As an aside, you know, I do put the vertical on the car during 6-meter DX season, which is coming up at the end of May, June, and July. And I, you know, with 20 watts, I was able to make DX around the country. So, I mean, I'm close to a deduction here saying that at least on ground wave, the horizontal is better.
When you did use the vertical and you experienced considerably less range, do you think the less range was a difference in gain, difference in polarization, or difference in noise? Did you experience a whole lot of noise that was drowning out the signals when you were vertically polarized? And if so, is there a chance that a good noise blanker would have helped? Back to you, Vinny.
Roger, Dick, good question. I believe it was the polarization, because there was a kilowatt being thrown at me from a 7-element beam, and it seemed to hit a cliff. At each point, both north and south of N1DVL, it would drop off very, very quickly. So my notion is that it was the polarization. Noise was not a factor. It just dropped off too quickly.
Okay. An interesting piece of evidence. So your experience would say try very hard to be co-polarized. And you also like the halo. If anybody listening to my voice can answer Howie number two's question, that is Big Wheel and Cloverleaf a similar antenna? K2KEY to take it. K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, like I say, the experiences in those days on AM on 6 meters. Now, I was running in a mobile about, I'd say, 25 watts. I'm trying to did I run 25 watts? Yeah, I think when I built that rig, I used a 2E26. Yeah. 2E. Final. And had a dynamotor for the hub. High voltage for the final small dynamotor, and I built also. I remember they came out with those tubes that came available. Those what they used to call low voltage, high current tubes, and it was a very nice circuit that was published to build a converter so that you could use the car radio as the tunable IF, and that was my setup in the mobile Dick for 6 meters over.
So for how many years did you operate that rig? Give me a rough guess as to how many people you talked to and what kind of DX you got with and without band openings. Tell us a little bit about what was it like in those days, Mobile 6 meters. I got the point that from a fixed location, 6 meters in those days could create a lot of devastation in the neighborhood. But Mobile-wise, what was it like, Mel? Go ahead.
Like I say, I knew a lot of guys, local guys, that got their tech license. So I did frequent 6 meters quite a bit from the Mobile. I had so much stuff in that car at the time, including HF radio. I had a kilowatt in the trunk for HF, and had the big Leisner valve system, alternators, two huge batteries. That car was really loaded with Mobile equipment. And so you look at it, it was quite an impressive thing. You see the halo on the car and the whip, the vertical, the regular HF whip and all. It was something. Now, how well did I do? Well, at the time, I took that car with me down when I was stationed down in Georgia. So I took the car down to Georgia with me. And a couple of times, actually, I was able, on 6 meters, to work a few of the technicians back here in Brooklyn. Most of them, of course, was not on a steady basis, but I did work them back. I told them that I would listen for them, and they would listen for me, and on 6 meters, and I would, tell the guys that had the general license or whatever at the time, that I alert them that, tell the 6 meter guys that I will give them a try at so-and-so time, or be on 10 meters and the heyday of great conditions on 10 meters and, tell them to go over to 6 and whatnot. So it did work quite well. I had some very good contacts, I'll tell you, on 6 meters. Dick, amazing, running AM in those days was a bit of the noise situation was a little bit more critical, but had great contacts on 6 meters. I wasn't even on quite a number of DX contacts in those days, even with AM over.
Were you lucky enough to be doing this during that huge peak in the sunspot cycle of around 1957-58? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was on with that. It was all part of that cycle, that famous cycle and all. And 10 meters was 24-hour operations, and you run a few watts on 10 meters and you work the world, literally. It was amazing that especially when the solar count that time went to 200 something, 10 to 20, it was just unbelievable what you heard. And people were coming up, of course, with all kinds of antennas this time. They were loading their bed springs, their window frames. Everybody came up with a twisted hanger of some sort and said, phenomenal, I worked 100 countries with it. So it was the heyday, Dick. I don't think in one lifetime we'll ever experience that again, I have a feeling. That was very abnormal, I think, condition. We're sitting here now on the bottom of this previous cycle for over 2 years, 2.5 years almost, and no sign of cycle 24 as far as the propagation for this week, over.
Yeah, what's interesting is that in the last 2 days, there's been a whole series of about 15 separate reports from 1296 operators in Europe, United States, Japan, Australia. They're all saying that the beacons they normally listen to, the over-the-horizon signals, all of a sudden are not there. Each of these groups of people are suspecting that their equipment had suddenly gone up in noise figure, or the beacons they used to listen to are not putting out the same power. However, if it happened in a particular area, you'd say, yeah, it's something local, but it seems to be happening worldwide. Under normal circumstances, the sunspot cycle should have no effect on 1296 megacycles. And these guys that tie into the microwave reflector, many of them are complaining and speculating as to what's going on. I'm getting the impression that this particular sunspot cycle, with its very long down period, is quite unusual once you get past the so-called Maunder minimum that occurred, I think, around 1615 or something like that, the year 1615. Have you been hearing people starting to speculate that this is an extremely unusual cycle as far as the lateness of it beginning the next rise? KQKEY, KQRIW.
According to NORN, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they had a, in fact, I get the bulletin from the propagation bulletin that they issue and all, and according to what they said, they are now thinking that it possibly is some kind of, well, maybe how severe a water minimum we're going to go through. The longest, of course, that measured time was 75 years. That started somewhere around 1615 or 20 or whatever it was, 1650, and went into the 1700s. So whether or not we're, hopefully we're not going to go through that kind of situation. But they said when you see this long a stretch of one cycle just about bottoming out and the other cycle showing little or no sign of beginning or begins a little bit and then disappears, it's usually an indication. And the fact that a couple of different, you know, little comments on there from different people, and they said, well, as long as we're not going to see the beginning of a new cycle, until we see that, that's the financial situation in this country and the world is also going to follow along the same path. That somebody made a chart and showed that when they've had these deep recessions back in the 80s and all, it coincides with the sunspot cycles of minimum and all. And is that possible? I don't know what to say, but I saw that comment a number of times, Dick, over.
Yeah, it's a little bit worrisome. To your knowledge, Mel, has anyone predicted how many sunspots we should have at this time if it was a normal cycle? Are we 10% behind? Or, well, we're sitting at zero, so you can't talk about percentages. But if this was a normal beginning at a normal timing of cycles, what's your guess as to how many sunspots we should be seeing at this time?
Be about a week, maybe a year and a half into the new cycle by now. So I would say that the it should have climbed by now, maybe up to somewhere around, the funny part is, really, if you look back and make a study of it, you'll find that a number of the cycles that began very slow in previous times had a fast rise all of a sudden and a fast demise. In other words, the peak seemed to be shortened, and they never came up to anywhere near the peaks of the longer stretch cycle. So, in other words, we may enter this new cycle a few years from now towards the time that the cycle will be on its downside, when we would be going on its downside. In other words, are we eating up now a good part of the cycle time? It's 11-year run. I don't know, really, but from, you know, only time will tell about what will happen with cycle 24. But in previous times, like I say, they showed that all of a sudden it comes up. Days are only a short period. If you know, part of it is disappears during the minimum tick over.
Okay, maybe this is going to make more of us into VHF operators, because the HF people suffer pretty badly when the ionosphere is not there, and the ionosphere really depends on the solar cycle an awful lot. I have the impression that 80 and 40 are not highly affected, but 20 through 10 meters certainly is. In fact, I haven't operated 80 enough to know, but does 80 behave very differently between the peak and the valley of a sunspot cycle? Back to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, there's been times last week or so that even 80 meters was quite, as I say, quiet at night. 40 was, when I usually take a listen to 40. If there's activity, decent amount of activity on 40, that usually means that 80 will also have some decent activity. I didn't hear much on 40, and I said, let me take a look at the 80, and sure enough, little or nothing. Few signals that I know on the CW portion. I operate mostly all CW. And so on the CW portion, stations that I know are always on. There's a couple of guys in Europe, one a couple out of Germany, a couple out of Sweden, all, they're always on the air. And I notice when their signal is down, I sort of gauge it by their signal. One guy I know in Germany quite well, he has quite an impressive antenna arrangement there, to say the least. So they're just about basically almost unheard, not being able to be heard at all. But I go over to 160, and there's the surprise. 160, many times I defies what is going on, that 160 could be well doing very well, and the other bands to be so quiet, it's hard to understand, you know, what exactly is really taking place that 160 should be sometimes the really great band, and the others should show literally nothing almost, Dick, over.
My impression is that the amount of ionosphere, its density, the requirement goes down as you go down in frequency. So although the ionosphere is kind of thin, it's still enough for 160. Is that a possible explanation?
Well, that's why they've had all kinds of explanations for what goes on in 160, and then a number of them just said that it's, in a way, it's, as they used to call 6 meters, the miracle band. They usually tag that also many times onto 160. Unusual band, unusual conditions on 160. It doesn't fit the mold, because there are times when 80 meters is great, and I figured, aha, 160 is going to be super good. You go over to 160, and it's dead. And 80 and 40, it's just the opposite. See, that's what I'm saying. That's what kills that theory. You would think, especially when 80 is doing quite well, that 160 should be doing even better, over.
Yep, they don't always correlate. Just to give you another example of a decorrelation, during the 10 gigahertz contests that take place in August and September, one weekend in August and one weekend in September, every year for the last 15 years or so, you've got a bunch of guys that operate from the mountaintops in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Vermont, and Maine. Quite often the guys that go up to Mount Equinox in New Hampshire, that's Vermont, or Mount Greylock in Massachusetts, and why can't I think of a big mountain in New Hampshire? Northern New Hampshire. What's the name of that big mountain in Northern New Hampshire, Mel? It'll come to me in a minute. But you got...
Talking about that mountain, oh boy, that mountain up there with the crazy weather conditions. it's funny, you just caught me.
Mount Washington, over at 6,000 feet.
That's the one. Thank you, sir. You get guys that go up there on Mount Washington, and they expect to really blast both on the 2-meter liaison frequency as well as on 10 gigahertz. And you'd be amazed how many times the guys on Mount Washington, you don't hear them on 2 meters, therefore you think you're not going to be able to work them on 10 gigs because you can't set up the contact. But you tune across 10 gigs anyhow with your antenna aimed in that direction, and they're gangbusters. So there are times when 10 gigs is coming through very loud, and 2 meters is essentially not there. Very similar to some of your experiences on 160, 80, and 40. Just because 80 is open, you think 160 would be blazing, and it may not be. It's those unpredictabilities, a part of what drives us to do experimenting on these bands. What kind of mail have you had this week, and should we be trying to answer some of that mail, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, the final words on it. I had a similar experience. I went up to upstate New York, up to High Point, New York, and they have a road that goes up to the monument up there that I was able to go up there because a friend that lived up there, his friend had a mutual friend that was the head ranger up there for their park service. So he opened the gate and drove my mobile right up to the monument, and you know, that's the highest spot in the tri-state area, and it stunk. Conditions up there were terrible. I couldn't believe it. Especially, I thought, boy, I get on 20 meters mobile up there at that altitude and everything up. Boy, I can't. This was terrible. I couldn't believe why I shouldn't with a line of sight like that. But there you are. I could say, not sometimes I'm not sure what is going on. I think I know something, and then I don't know something. You know, I can't come up with an answer. So, I would assume that there's more to radio, Dick, and propagation and all than we really understand fully, because all the charts and things and all, there's things that don't fit the mold many times over.
Yeah, I can support that numerically a little bit. In the case of VHF frequencies, you go up on top of a mountain versus a high mountain versus a low mountain, and the signals may be 15 dB difference in signal strength. On HF bands, where you're depending on the ionosphere, the reflection of the ionosphere can easily make the signal 80 decibels stronger. That's a lot of difference in amplitude. The fact that that signal is reflecting off the ionosphere versus going out there and a little bit of forward propagated tropospheric scatter due to atmospheric inhomogeneities gives you a little bit of signal above or beyond that horizon. But that signal is going to be super weak compared to even a feeble ionosphere. If the ionosphere is giving you what we call a reflection, I think it's really a refraction, but when it's working, it can make an S1 signal go to 20 over 9. And let me think now. 54 plus 74. Yeah, that's approaching 80 decibels of difference. So going on top of the mountain, if the ionosphere is not there, you don't have anywhere near the number of dBs you need. That's one way of looking at it, Mel. K2RIW.
The only problem was that when I was operating mobile driving along the road, I was working 20 meters quite well, and all of a sudden I didn't expect it to drop almost to nothing. I mean, it's just as if something, I said, something's gone wrong here with something, and I had to look at the meter and everything, and all, everything SWR-wise or whatever, everything looked okay. I was just flabbergasted to see, all of a sudden I figured, oh boy, I'll get on 10, 15, 20 or whatever, and I'll be, you know, working out like gangbusters. But it doesn't seem to be that way. So, you know, you say, oh boy, if I could select a QTH and gee, I'll put it on top of a mountaintop and then have this kind of a situation, oh boy, I guess you'd be a really disappointed person after investing maybe lots of money or buying a piece of property up there, a home, a tower and everything, and then find out that a guy some distance away running a much more moderate setup is doing quite better than you. I mean, that would be a sort of a hell of a letdown, to say the least, Dick. Over.
N2GOT with a comment on that.
Okay, how we recognize, but be careful, Mel. You don't want to generalize in the particular. You operate a mountaintop operation, and it's going to be a lot more days in which you're happy. The fact that on this one occasion, you went through a heroic effort to get to the top of that mountain and didn't see super signals when the ionosphere wasn't there, that shouldn't be thoroughly discouraging. N2GOT, K2RIW.
Yeah, Dick, 6 or 7 years ago, WBXO, WB2BXO Frank and myself went up to Mount Washington in New Hampshire, in the White Mountain area. I'm listening to Mel laughing because I had a very similar situation. We were up there during the week, and I got a lot of descents, interference up there, and did not have SSB equipment with me at that time. And I had made very, very few contacts up there on Mount Washington, believe it or not. I guess you have to go up there during like a VHF contest. Back to you, Dick, and CGOT.
Howard, what frequency were you using on Mount Washington?
2 meters FM only, and the antenna was a Diamond SG7500, and I was also on 10 meters. Did not have an HF, any other HF frequencies, just 10 meters. And if I remember correctly, there's a lot of RF up there. I think there's maybe some other people that are on here that know what kind of RF is up there in on Mount Washington, but there's a hell of a lot of RF in that area.
Call from 4148.
Is there somebody signing in from the internet?
No, that was me trying to get your attention. I had a comment for you.
Go ahead, Joe.
Many of these high mountains have a lot of commercial equipment up there, and even though it's way, way, way out of band compared to RF, the signal strength of these things is tremendous compared to what you're trying to receive. Now, Mel said you went up there and also the HF dropped. Did your noise floor go up as you went up near the top of this mountain, or did it stay relatively the same like you were on the ground level?
Yeah, Don, good question. Go ahead, Mel.
I'll tell you something. It was like a dead zone up there. It was amazing. It was quiet every which way. Noise level wise and everything, I don't understand. It was just like a desert of nothing, of a radio desert, basically, up there. And, I was going to try to demonstrate the ham equipment to this ranger. And when I told him, I said, I don't know what happened here and all. He says, you know, I think one of the guys also had a relative or something that used to do this ham radio stuff. And he says it stinks up here. I think that was his exact comment. So, possibility that there's more going on than meets the eye, Dick. In fact, I tell you something, overall, it seems like the guys that get out the best are these maritime mobiles. I work so many guys on ships, you know, that are in the merchant marine and things and all, and they just rave how well they get out, Dick, on the ocean over.
EC2, QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, this is just based on experience, but what I've always found operating mobile is that my vertically mounted antennas on the mobile, when I'm closer to the seashore, or the closest I can get to the ocean, I get the best possible signal response ever. The further I get away from the seashore, it still works well, but never as good as it does down by like an area like Jones Beach. You get your mobile down there, and you park in one of the parking lots, and it's amazing the signal you'll have. Take the same mobile, vertically polarized antenna, and drive up to the top of a mountain, and it's pretty poor. But what's interesting is take along a wired dipole antenna with you and string it along across a tree, so in some mountainous area up there, and gangbusters, it comes right back. But it's like, it seems like horizontal wants to work a whole lot better in the mountains, and then if you try the vertical on your mobile, it's very, very poor. And the exact opposite at the beach. If you try to string out a horizontal dipole at the beach, it just never seems to work. Just an experience that I've noticed. KC2, QIQ.
That horizontal dipole on the beach that didn't work well, roughly how far above water or above land was it, Glenn?
Not high at all, Dick. I would say maybe just like stringing between fences and off of like 10 feet poles. But I'm really comparing apples with apples here because I've strung dipoles up in the mountains off of a small low hung tree branch to a broomstick handle that's about 10 feet off the ground, but just the elevation of the mountain, horizontal polarized, it works beautiful.
And you know the way ground reflection from a very good conductive ground on horizontal polarization gives you almost a null on the horizon and a peak that's a large number of degrees above the horizon. You're familiar with that characteristic, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, pretty much, but I'm not sure it explains everything, Dick.
Okay, it will explain a lot. The fact that a horizontally polarized wave with a good conducting ground plane experiences a reversal on the signal balance, reversal of phase. So you've really got a real dipole above the water and a virtual dipole, a mirror image of one below the water. They're out of phase with each other. That gives you a null on the horizon and a peak, let me pick a number, 30 degrees above the horizon. And on HS frequencies, 30 degrees above the horizon is too steep to give you a bounce off the ionosphere. You've got to be much closer to a grazing angle when you hit the ionosphere to get a good reflection. That's a guess. So I guess a guy who is on vacation doing ham radio and going to operate one day from a beachfront, another day from a mountaintop, it looks to me like the smart guy has both horizontal and vertical antennas. You're a guy that has both, isn't that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, I have the screwdriver antenna, the Tar Heel, inside the vehicle, which is just for ease. You know, it's easy to program with the ICOM 7000. But I also have basically a couple of dipoles that I've strung up. You know, just I can kind of like run them off the back of my Jeep with some egg-shaped insulators and hook it around a tree if I want to, if I get up into a nice big picnic area or into a large area where I can just, you know, string the wires out. And, you know, I got like a 62-foot length one for like 80, you know, and different all the way down to like 20 meters. And I don't think I carry anything wire for 10, but, you know, pretty much like 20, 40, and 80. I keep those because they roll up really easy. It's amazing. And there's another little antenna I've used, too. It's like a little slinky antenna, and you can kind of like stretch it out. That's kind of neat, too, but it's, you kind of have to measure it a little bit when you're, and it's a little bit more bulky, but it stores nicely.
When you're on a mobile operation and when you want to string these antennas high above the ground, do you do it with a slingshot-like mechanism?
Now, most of the time, I find let me put it this way. A lot of times, like, if I'm tuning my vertical and it's not working, I found that usually the horizontal antenna doesn't have to be all that high off the ground. It's usually up in an area like where I'm up in my cousin's in Vermont and St. Albans, or up in the New Hampshire area. I'm up inside there where I'm up in the mountains, or down in Shenandoah Mountains in the Carolinas, that area over there. And, you know, I find it generally that I don't have to be all that high off the ground. Sometimes just, hook it around a low, you know, hung tree branch, just make sure it's off the ground, and generally it works. You know, it's kind of interesting.
Sounds nice and portable. Okay, yeah. Mel, want to dig into the mailbag? Choice is yours.
Now, I just will say that I've seen Glenn's mobile setup quite impressive with that amplifier he built. Very, very nice setup. Yeah, I agree with him. I used to, every day on the way home, make sure that I could join the 247 DX net on 20 meters years ago when I was working. On the way home, I'd go take the Belt Parkway, and I didn't mind getting even sometimes at the traffic jams because I had the mobile rig on 20 meters at the time working that DX net and joining that net. And boy, oh boy, did I work. I worked over, I don't remember, about most likely close to, I'd say, 200 countries from the mobile. It was amazing, staying along the ocean there, and it worked out phenomenally well. And I know I never had any really luck with the mobile rig on HF when I went anywhere inland. Stay around the ocean and all or whatever, and that's why I think even this location that I am, only a few hundred feet off the Atlantic Ocean, is responsible for how well it works here, Dick. Over.
Location, location, location. Anybody on the internet wants to sign in, I'm going to give a nice long delay on my next pass over to Mel. And of all the bands you've operated, which one's your favorite? That's a question that I've quite often asked people when I talk to them for the first time. You're 10 minutes into a conversation. It's not just a hello, goodbye, you're 5 and 9 in New York, and send me a QSL card. Just want to make sure that somebody isn't trying to break in. But that's one of the good questions. Is there any mail that we should be handling? No? Your choice. KQRAW.
Okay, I'll get to that in a second. I'll just make the final comment on it. If I had to select, if somebody says, well, you guys are just all going to have to pick the band that you're going to operate at and mode, I'll take 30 meters CW. There is, when that band, when we get halfway decent conditions, 30 CW, especially most of the time during the daytime, is great. When we had good nighttime conditions, it was fabulous. It just happens to be at the right place between 40 and 20 meters. Has characteristics of both, and boy, I worked guys with that were running very modest, low power, QRP, modest antennas and all, and all over the world. And of course, the power that is, I think the maximum power you're allowed on that band is like 200 watts. so it gives everybody sort of a level playing field. But beautiful conditions on that band when it's open, Dick. So overall, 30 CW is really a band that really I could really honestly say I've enjoyed immensely over.
Yeah, my guess is it's not super populated. So you're not living with a whole lot of crowded QR Mary conditions. QR Nancy, I guess, is nowhere near as bad in, the, let's say, the summertime as 80 meters could be, or 160. Static crashes are nowhere near as bad. The antennas are not super big. So you get a lot of bang for the money, and you're a guy who enjoys the art form of a clean sent Morse code. And I think you've told me from time to time you will listen to Morse code as you go to sleep because it's very resting for the brain. I have to repeat that one. I think you've said that to me. Over to you, Mel.
I call it my sleeping pill. I relax with Morse code. Just listen to CW many times. I used to listen, towards the end when I was already starting to fade off. being that I said I better not do any sending because I'll most likely be sending gibberish already. One eye is basically closed. And I'm sitting back with the headphones on. I listen to some QSOs or listen to a DX station working everybody all over the world. I'm hearing places calling in from them. Oh, used to hear places, that these guys only could get on CW, a lot of these real exotic places, because they hadn't had the wherewithal to buy anything other than some little piece of equipment that they could stick together. A basic radio, and of course, what do you do with a basic radio? Get on CW. So it was really fascinating sometimes to hear places that you'd never hear them on phone. Not at all. Maybe things have changed somewhat now, but back in those days, they were really a rarity to hear, and they only were on CW. So if you didn't operate CW, you had little or no chance of working a number of these places, Dick, over.
And if you're a country counter, a card collector, you want to be on the DXCC, DX honor roll, that's the way to do it. My guess is it's, four times harder to work 300 countries purely on sideband as opposed to Morse code. Is that a number that might be true, Mel?
I know of a couple of stations that I've worked that will only be on CW because I could say, for a fact, there's one, a couple of them. There's one guy in the Indian Ocean that I've worked up in several places and on these islands in the Indian Ocean. He happens to be stationed on Diego Garcia, and any time he gets a spare time, he takes his battery, battery that he has, and his little rig, and goes to one of these islands, strings up, like you say, a antenna between a couple of palm trees, and gets on there on CW, and that's it, and operates till the battery goes dead. If he has no way of recharging on it, in other words, he's got to carry everything that he wants to use the ham radio on his back, literally. So it's a modest setup, but I've worked on a number of these. I've got some QSL cards from him from Numbers Islands and all, and you never hear them on the air because they're never activated other than when he goes there. This guy, Jim Cleary, JC, he's quite a nice guy. I've worked him a number of times. In fact, I even got to speak to him on the telephone when he came back. He lives in Florida, and he called me once on the phone to ask me a question. So this is the only way he's operated with CW, Dick, and operated some rare good locations, over.
Hands to IJU.
Mr. IJU, give us a name and go ahead with your comment or question.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen. Name over here is Phil Call, hands to IJU. I just got myself a little HT, basically the first time back on the air in about 20 years, and I had heard you guys talking about CW and the sort. I have a real quick question, though. When I got my technician's license back in the 80s, I had to know Morse code. So, does my license class change in any way? I mean, does it get upgraded to general, being that I had to take the code back then?
I'm going to pass it over to Mel for this one, but I'm fairly sure there is no longer any requirement for Morse code for the entry level of exams. I think Morse code has been essentially eliminated as a licensing requirement. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Definite. There are no more CW requirements for any amateur radio license. It's all gone. And that, in fact, I think CW is the only place that's being still has any, I guess if you hear CW on the air anywhere, it's got to be a ham radio operator. I don't think there's any commercial use anywhere anymore with CW, as far as I understand it. Maritime, everything has been phased out. They got rid of those emergency calling frequencies, the famous SOS frequencies and all that stuff. I think is all just finished. So it's the only place is the hams that are using it, but that's about the only situation, and you don't need it for a ham license anymore, over.
Copy. So my question was this. When I got my technician's license 20 years ago, over 20 years ago, I had to take code in order to get the license. Now that I'm back on the air 20 years later, I'm just wondering, as a result of me having to take the code back then, do I get an automatic upgrade, or am I still considered as a technician who may have just become newly licensed?
Let me into all my life.
Go ahead, Joe.
When I upgraded to General a couple of years ago before I upgraded to Advanced Extra, the rule back then was if you could prove you had a technician class license according to the U.S. call book, the ARRR call book or U.S. call book, and could prove it before March 1987, you could be automatically grandfathered up to a General class licensee because at the time they still had the code being held at 5 words a minute. That's what it was back then. I'm not sure if that changed. It probably wouldn't affect you at all if you go into any of these test sessions and can prove you've had a license, technician license before March 1987, you can get grandfathered right up into the general class license.
Okay. And so I get here, well then I guess, if I understand you correctly, then I technically should be a general and not a technician.
If you were licensed before 1987, the answer is yes.
Yep, I was. In fact, I first got licensed, I believe, was in 85.
Well, so.
Go ahead, Frank.
Okay, you're not automatically a general. You need to take the proof of your license prior to 1987 with you to a VE session, and once you prove to them that you qualify, they submit the paperwork to the FCC and you become a general. I know this for a fact because my cousin was similarly circumstanced, and I brought him to a VE session at the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club, and that's the way he did it. So don't just automatically think you've got a general license and start transmitting on the general bands, because you can get in trouble. And to RSL, back to that.
Good information, Frank. Thank you. Bill, any further questions?
No, that pretty much answered it pretty much for me then. I got to go in the drawer and look. Or maybe if I can't find the original license, they could probably look it up. I'm sure there's got to be some record of it somewhere with the FCC, but I'm definitely going to look into that. But like I said, I just bought myself a Yaesu VX8R, and this is basically my first time back on the air since like 1989.
Welcome back. And a lot has changed since then, I can tell you. And but step by step, you'll learn all the new vocabulary and rigs and whatever. Computers and frequency synthesizers and digital modes. Lots of things are changing. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. FM repeater ham radio, what you're doing right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. And for some reason, you're not happy with it, you might not want to give up the hobby before trying one of the other 25 kinds, Bill. When it comes to operating with a battery, Dale Clement, Alpha Foxtrot 1 Tango, he's a VHF, UHF operator from way back. What he does almost every year, during the 10 gigahertz weekend of the contest, there's one weekend in August and one weekend in September, he takes his gel cell battery, fully charged, to Martha's Vineyard. He gets there by way of a ferry, and I think he's got something like 5 or 10 watts of output capability, and he operates for the whole weekend on that gel cell battery. I'm relatively sure by the time the weekend is over, that battery is very close to fully discharged, which is a mildly destructive process, in my opinion, because gel cell or lead-acid batteries, if you discharge them beyond the 25% charge cushion, beyond the 50% point, you start doing permanent damage, so if the next time you fully charge it, it doesn't have as many watt hours. If I know Dale, he's probably smart enough to use a brand new one each time, but that's really portable operation. He's operating from a beachfront on Martha's Vineyard. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Budges, K2KEY. Well, something has become very popular with a lot of these QRPers and all in those situations. They have this solar panel that folds up. It's 24 inches square, 2x2 square, and it folds up with a handle, a carrying handle. And what you do, you get the location, you unfold it, and it folds out, and I think four panels unfold. And I don't remember how much it produces exactly, but it gives a good showing of itself. And if you have a sunny day, it will definitely give you the power that you need for keeping the QRP station on the air. Use a gel cell as the backup, but it basically will, you know, the duty cycle of transmitting, receiving, definitely when you're receiving mode, it's more than sufficient to run the receiving mode of the rig, and at the same time it's putting the charge, some of it, putting charge back into the battery. So that's become a very popular gadget with a number of these people that are going off to these different places now, Dick, over.
That's an excellent idea. While you take a break for lunch, sun is charging your batteries. What's the total area that you believe can conveniently be carried with foldable solar cells? What's your guess as to the total area in square feet, square meters, whatever, Mel? Go ahead.
Like I say, this one is 2 foot square, and it carries with a, looks like a folded table, you know, when it's cute looking. When it's all folded up, it's a very pleasant looking, you know, it's finished, has a nice carrying handle. So you open it up, you've got four panels, 2 foot square each, thick. What are they capable of? I think each panel is capable of most likely at 12 volts, maybe about, maybe at least, would you say 500 mils, over?
We can calculate this one, ballpark, not too bad, Mel. I know that the sun on a really clear sunny day gives you a little shy of 1,300 watts per square meter. A 2 foot by 2 foot solar panel, total of 4 square feet. Let's see, 1 square meter is very close to 10 square feet. So you get 20% of a square meter is your total area. If I assume that I'm getting 20% of 1,200 watts, one-fifth of 1,200 watts. I've got a calculator here. All of a sudden, my ability to do mental math has degraded. I'm going to make it 1,300 watts. 1,300 watts. 20% of that is 260. Assuming the solar cells are running 15% efficiency, which is another thing to consider, that's only 39 watts. But that's not bad. 39 watts at 12 volts is around 3 1/4 amperes. I think you might get 3 amperes of charge out of it. 3.5 amperes of charge out of that mount. What do you think?
If I'm not mistaken, I asked one of the guys, and I think he said about 500 mils a panel, so he got 4 panels, around 2 amps. Most likely, maybe if the sun is shining, get it at the right angle, you may squeeze it a little bit more. But listen, like you say, you take a break for lunch or whatever, you know, you're not going to be operating continuous, and if you can pump a couple of amperes per hour back into those batteries, you're surely going to be able to get through the weekend with a modest setup, Dick. So I think it's ideal for people that like to backpack and do things like that and go to these places and have a great old time with ham radio. You can do a heck of a lot with, a modest setup and have, like I say, have a lot of fun with it, over.
Now, that 2-foot by 2-foot foldable solar panel array, when it's all folded up, how heavy